Well, the title of my talk is rather obscure for a reason. Don't worry, the talk itself won't be. But this is, while this has become a pretty exciting topic in relativity and astrophysics over the last 4 years or so, this came about by people putting together various bits of trivia that had been moldering around in other people's bottom drawers for a couple of decades. And it tells us a bunch of strange things, like how the Coriolis force could make gravitational waves, how superconductivity and superfluidity could actually dramatically increase the viscosity of a fluid, and all sorts of other counterintuitive stuff. You know, winds up taking us on a tour of a wide variety of issues in theoretical physics and giving some pretty strange answers, which personally I think is the great thing about it. Although the reasons that the community's been excited about it are rather more pragmatic and concrete. So the basic idea then is that there's this set of fluid oscillation modes in neutron stars called the R modes that, you know, like all oscillations of the matter, they'll emit some gravitational waves, but the back reaction of the waves doesn't damp them out, it amplifies them. So they make more waves, which grow the mode some more, and on until something interesting happens, potentially. You could wind up taking a lot of energy and angular momentum out of a star, which is really neat. So there are basically three things that people have really focused on. For one thing, there's a long-standing problem in astrophysics now as to why young pulsars, like say the Crab, spin very slowly, something in order, like an order of magnitude slower than they could be. So I should say that the fastest known pulsar is spinning at something like 600 hertz. This is an old object. The young ones, like the Crab now, seem to be spinning, or when you allow for electromagnetic braking, they seem to have been spinning something like 60 hertz when they were born, which is really funny. When you have a supernova core collapse, you have stuff crunching down, you would think that conservation of angular momentum is going to make this thing spin up like mad to the fastest it possibly can, so that you're shedding stuff off of the equator. Clearly, in the Crab, this is not happening. Crab's nowhere near, and the other young ones are nowhere near that limit either, pretty much. There's a related puzzle now, related to these things called low-mass X-ray binaries, or LMXBs. These are systems where you talk about a neutron star in orbit with a low-mass normal star companion. The neutron star is grabbing matter off of its companion. The stuff is accreting onto the neutron star, heating up and emitting X-rays. So people observe these oscillations in the X-rays, and they think because of these X-rays, they're seeing something related to the spin period, and that implies that these things are spinning around 300 hertz, around 400 hertz at most. That's pretty puzzling too. You would think that these systems would be getting spun up like mad, because some of them are accreting matter at a tremendous rate. They should be torqued up, well, if they can get up to 600 hertz, well, they should be getting up to 600 hertz, but they're not. The R modes provide one possible explanation for this as well. Finally, last but certainly not least, the gravitational waves people have gotten excited about this. The LIGO people have gotten excited about this because in the process of spinning down a young neutron star by maybe a factor of 10, or keeping a lid on the spin rate of an old neutron star, an older neutron star in a low-mass X-ray binary, the R mode instability has the potential to make gravitational waves that are actually detectable by LIGO in a reasonable time frame. Now this is, I should say, this is not LIGO as it's operating today. It's still in this initial shakedown phase. This is what's typically called enhanced LIGO, which is a set of improvements to the mirrors and suspensions and bit-by-bit improvements that's scheduled for something like a four or five year time frame. And I should say that this is competitive with detecting neutron star binary end spirals, which is pretty much what LIGO was built for. So optimistically, people have been thinking maybe the R mode instability would be competitive with that. Okay, so the first question that people usually ask is, what are the R modes anyway? They're not exactly a household word. The name of the game here is rotation. I should say, in some sense, this whole business of modes of neutron stars and things that are related to the R modes actually goes back to the 19th century, but this particular rather obscure little family of modes was named and studied by a couple of astronomers in 1978, 20 odd years ago, and pretty much ignored since then. The idea is that neutron stars are very complicated objects. You bang on them, they ring off in all sorts of ways. There are F modes, G modes, P modes, S modes, T modes, W modes, probably some more I've forgotten about. They're generally named after whatever's controlling the dynamics. Name of the game for the R modes is rotation. So the idea here is that the restoring force is the Coriolis force. This is pretty important for various reasons we'll see later on. And so maybe people are more familiar with the P-modes, certainly the astrophysics. You know, typically you get some, pressure is the dominant restoring force in a lot of oscillations. That's what sets the mode frequencies. And those are, so the P-modes are global acoustic waves, and the R-modes are sort of related in the same way to global Rossby waves, which is another thing that people might be more familiar with from looking at waves in the Earth's oceans. A couple people are nodding, but I see an awful lot of blank looks. Well, that should tell you something, how obscure the R-modes are, that the Rossby waves are actually the familiar version. Okay, so what does an R-mode look like? Mathematically, they're actually pretty simple to write down. There's some kind of a velocity perturbation that has a fairly straightforward power law radial dependence. There's this spherical harmonic. This funny-looking angular term, it turns out, this R cross gradient of a scalar harmonic, is something that's known to the aficionados as a magnetic-type vector spherical harmonic. And the reason for that is there's no divergence. It's all curl. And that's important because it means that what these things are, this delta V is a big moving circulation pattern. As to what it looks like, well, the R-modes are a bit tricky to graph for various reasons. Here's a version I like. This is actually taken from a review by Lee Lindblom pretty recently. But here we have a snapshot, or actually a couple of snapshots. We've got one camera looking down on the pole of a neutron star. It's rotating around. And here's another one looking at the equator running across here. So what these arrows are directions of instantaneous fluid flow. So you see there are these big loops, these big gyres alternating counterclockwise, clockwise, counterclockwise, clockwise as you go around the star longitudinally. And that's basically a big moving circulation pattern. Now, the lines here, these big ellipses going from pole to pole, are what would be streamlines if this flow pattern stayed in place. But it doesn't. Now, the fluid itself isn't moving pole to pole. To see what's happening to the fluid, you would actually want to look at what happens as this pattern moves around on the star. It doesn't move at the same rate as the rotation of the star either. So if you track an individual fluid element, say this one, it starts off with the velocity vector pointing upward, and as the pattern moves through that fluid element, the velocity vector tips over, moves to the left, moves down again. And what's going on when you track the individual fluid elements is they're executing these little ellipses, and the ellipses are horizontal, which is what you would expect since the Coriolis force is the restoring force. Remember, it's going to go like delta V cross R, so it's perpendicular to delta V. That's why you kick a fluid element, it gets dragged around an ellipse. It's perpendicular to R, that's why it's horizontal. And that's very important. So they do exist all the way down. The strength of the velocity perturbation goes as R to some power, R squared for the one we're typically interested in. So it does extend all the way down into the core. What I showed you is just the surface, which is where the motion is biggest, but it does go all the way down. Okay, so the fact that you're moving these little horizontal ellipses is very important physically because it means you've got very small density perturbations. In fact, strictly speaking, for this basic perturbation I wrote down here, there's no density perturbation. You have to go up to higher order in omega, the angular velocity of the star, which is always a small number in some well-defined sense, in order to get the density perturbation. And that's important when we're talking later about bulk viscosity, among other things. A second important fact that's due to the Coriolis force controlling these things is that the mode frequencies are proportional to, and generally, in fact, comparable to, the spin frequency of the star. So typically, for the ones we're interested in, the factors like 4/3 or so. And when you work out the proportionality factors in front, it turns out that there's this funny property that if you compare the mode frequency in an inertial frame, little omega, to this stuff in parentheses, which is the mode frequency in a rotating frame, they disagree in sign. Now, the physical content of that mathematical statement is that the circulation pattern I showed you is moving around prograde, or in the same direction as the rotation of the star, as seen by someone sitting out at infinity, an inertial observer. But if you go and sit on the star and you're rotating around with it, you'll see this mode pattern moving around retrograde or backwards. That's really a key point because that's where the instability comes from. Now, the gravitational radiation instability is actually pretty generic. You may have heard of it, although it had kind of fallen out of favor for a while. You may have heard it in various contexts recently as the CFS instability. And this is after Chandrasekhar, who first happened on an instance of it in 1970, and then John Friedman and Bernie Schütz spent the greater part of the 1970s building up this mathematical formalism, basically importing techniques from quantum mechanics, perturbation theory, to apply them to rotating fluids and show that the instability is for real and that it's generic. There's an awful lot of very dense mathematically written papers about this, and I'm going to take a very different tack here. I'm going to skim over a lot of that. And actually, it turns out that the gist of the argument can be expressed quite simply in a hand-wavy sense. That is, you take any mode, not necessarily an R mode. People typically looked at this for other modes, F modes, G modes, and things like that. You take any mode that satisfies this frequency criterion, so the mode is prograde in one frame, retrograde in the other. What you find is that, in some sense, gravitational radiation lives in an inertial frame, so it thinks the mode is prograde. Therefore, the mode is some positive perturbation on the angular momentum and the energy of the star. And therefore, radiation is going to take away positive angular momentum and energy from the star, make them more negative. Now, the way the instability gets set up is that the fluid, of course, is living in this rotating frame. It thinks the mode is retrograde. Therefore, it's a negative perturbation, in some sense, of the angular momentum and energy of the star. Since the radiation is making these quantities go more negative, it must be growing the absolute values of the angular momentum and the energy. And therefore, it's growing the mode amplitude. Now, there's a lot of mathematical subtlety I'm skipping over here. It's a bit much to go through in a talk, and I've got a lot of physics to cover, but it really is an amazing piece of work that these guys were able to apply quantum mechanical tools to rotating fluids. Some of you may have looked at this sort of stuff, and for those of you who haven't, this is a notoriously difficult subject. People have been trying to deal with fluid mechanics since Euler, usually pretty unsuccessfully. And perturbation theory in rotating fluids is beset by all sorts of technical difficulties. You have to be very careful about defining a very precise, good canonical energy function, for example, because you can make perturbations that mathematically look okay, but physically they're there's relabeling the fluid elements, and that's nonsense. Those shouldn't radiate. So you have to perform a lot of games to define your quantities very carefully so that they ignore all the spurious stuff. This sort of thing does tend to intimidate and confuse people even today, frankly, and it's pretty slippery for me to grab, and I've been knee-deep in it for the past 4 years, so I tend to think of the instability and the reason why it works in terms of a simpler physical analogy, or maybe educational caricature is a better word. So think of the following situation, okay? This is one that's very relevant to Santa Barbara. Let's say you're hanging out in the water, all right, and there's some air over the water and it's not moving. The water's not moving, air's not moving, until you slap the water, okay? Now you make this wave go off in some direction. It's propagating, it's interacting with the air somehow. Now in real life, meteorology is a very complicated science. There's all sorts of stuff going on, but your physical intuition probably tells you when you do this that the net effect of it, of the air interacting with the wave, is going to be something like a frictional force that's going to act to oppose whatever the wave's doing. That is, the wave's going to travel for a while, it's going to get energy taken out, it's going to die away, everything's going to go back to being flat and still. Fine, that's how dissipation should work. But it doesn't always work like that, because even in the case of wind and waves, suppose now, you're in the water and you let a wind come up. So that the wind's going, and now you slap the water again, you make this wave go off in the same direction as the wind's blowing, but not as fast. Now, from the air's point of view, that wave is actually traveling backwards, and so this sort of effective frictional coupling, whatever it is going to try and drag the wave forwards, and it's going to have to help it out to do that. It's going to have to pump energy into it. It's going to wind up growing the amplitude of the wave in some regime until, something funny happens. So the net result is some small initial perturbation gets amplified rather than damped out, as you would normally expect. Now, this kind of thing happens all over the place in physics. There's a wide class of these things called For what I trust are obvious reasons, to stream instabilities. You know, the idea is anytime you've got this disagreement between two frames of reference as to what way a disturbance is propagating, there's a potential for dissipation to get confused and grow a small disturbance instead of damp it out. And you get, you know, some sort of version of Kelvin-Helmholtz, and you get all sorts of things happening in weather, for instance. This is why you get a lot of turbulent stuff boiling off of the jet stream, for instance, and why some airplane rides are pretty bumpy. And it turns out the CFS instability, broadly speaking, is the same thing. You can just take this picture, now, you know, grab the corners and wrap it around, so instead of translational symmetry across here, you have rotational symmetry. You know, you're looking down on the pole of the neutron star. You know, instead of water, you got neutron star stuff. Instead of air, you got vacuum. And now the coupling between them is gravitational radiation. And it's the same thing. You've got this disturbance propagating around one way in one frame, the other way in the other. And the dissipation, in this case, the radiation, gets confused about which way it should act. Okay, so if you've been watching the dates on these, you're seeing all these papers from the 1970s. The pieces for this calculation have been lying around for 20 odd years, but no one was paying attention to them. Well, why? For one thing, people had neglected the R modes, and they're kind of weird. They're different from all the other modes. So people did get excited about CFS, but they were generally looking at more normal sorts of modes, like F modes, for example. And the results, after 20 years or so of work, were not very encouraging. In a nutshell, it turned out that when you look at the other modes of neutron stars, they only have this difference in sign between the frequencies, this prograde retrograde confusion. Either when you're looking at a very high angular velocity for the star, basically, you know, for P modes to get affected, their frequency affected by the Coriolis force has to be comparable to the pressure, and then, you know, the star's about to fly apart at that point. Alternatively, you could get them to work for very high mode quantum numbers, the usual spherical harmonic quantum number here, and that's bad because then there's a lot of spatial variation in the flow across the star, and that means not in perfect fluids, but in real neutron stars, there's a lot of shear viscosity that's going to damp out the instability. And it turned out that it generally damped it out faster than the radiation could grow it, except possibly in some very small and uninteresting range of conditions. So things were pretty quiet for 20 years, until summer of 97. Niels Andersen was going through cataloging a whole bunch of different sets of modes, this whole tribe of modes, and he included this obscure thing called the R modes that he dug up somewhere. He was on the phone with John Friedman about some instabilities in his code, and Friedman says, "Ah, well, there's a physical instability too. You should check this frequency criterion." And he goes off and he does that, and lo and behold, the R modes, it turns out, satisfy this frequency criterion for all quantum numbers and all angular velocities. So in not neutron stars necessarily, but all rotating balls of perfect fluid are unstable to gravitational radiation. Now that's really interesting by itself. But there's more. People took a while to get a handle on the gravitational radiation. In fact, in some sense, it took 20 years to get a handle on the gravitational radiation, because in an ironic twist, it turns out Papaloiseau and Pringle, these same guys who coined the term R-modes in 1978, had another paper right after the Friedman-Schütz paper came out. These guys read it in 1978 and popped out another paper estimating, you know, whether all these various families of modes would be subject to this instability in real life. And of course, they knew about the R-modes. They considered them for an entire sentence before tossing them out, because, as I said before, this density perturbation is a very small quantity in some well-defined sense. And the way that people traditionally look at gravitational radiation is they say it's coming from time-varying changes in this mass quadrupole, which is, you know, the usual sort of thing. You make this symmetric trace-free tensor out of a volume integral, basically, of delta rho times some coordinate stuff. And delta rho is small, therefore the change in the mass quadrupole is small. You ignore it. People did ignore it for 20 years. This is where I come in, actually. I'd been off working on some post-Newtonian stuff, which is basically, you know, since real gravity is too hard to deal with, you expand the Einstein equations and everything in sight in powers of V over C and keep a few leading order terms. Now, when you do that, it turns out there's this interesting thing. There's a range of things called gravitomagnetic effects. people may actually be more familiar with this in the relativity group with relation to things like frame dragging and whatnot, but there's a very simple example, the reason for the name, in fact, if you look at the equation of motion for a test body in the post-Newtonian expansion. So if you look at an object moving in a gravitational field, the acceleration, you know, the stuff in parentheses, has this electrical term, as they call it. That's just the gradient of a scalar potential. That's the usual Newtonian gravity that everybody knows about. And then the next order term, or what is usually considered the next order term, is this V cross B term, where this B, this gravitomagnetic field, is something that comes out of the curl of a vector potential, and that vector potential comes out of mass currents in exactly the same way that the usual magnetic one comes out of electrical currents. It's just the constants in front are different. So one of the things you see in post-Newtonian theory is that anytime you're talking about spins and circulation and stuff, this the order counting gets all screwed up. And actually, this gravitomagnetic stuff can be sometimes more important than the more familiar electric-type stuff. So these gravitomagnetic effects appear in all sorts of unexpected places in relativity, and radiation is no exception. So here's another bit of 20- or 30-year-old trivia that had been lying around. It turns out that there's this set of things called current quadrupole, or current multipoles. The dominant one's the current quadrupole, and they radiate too. So a current quadrupole is a symmetric trace-free tensor that looks sort of like an angular momentum integral with an extra index on it. The important thing, anyway, is that it's got a delta V in it. You don't need a delta rho. You can have a delta V, which can be big for the R modes, whereas delta rho is small. And when you work out the scaling on the back of the envelope, it turns out this means the gravitational radiation driving is 10 to the 6 times faster than people thought. And now that's really cool too, but that's still not enough. I mean, we're just talking about perfect fluids here. And in real life, the universe doesn't have a whole lot of balls of perfect fluid floating around. There's really, you know, dirty, nasty, complicated, interesting neutron stars with all sorts of neat physics going on, and you need to deal with that. So the way that you do that is basically you include as much physics as you can, and you try and evaluate how fast the mode is being driven and how fast it's being damped. Damping or driving rates, or equivalently, damping and driving time scales, which are inverse of the rates. And there's a pretty standard way that you do that now. You know, it's the usual damped-driven harmonic oscillator problem. You assume that your velocity perturbation has some exponentially growing or decaying part in addition to the oscillation, and you just plug in a bunch of numbers. Basically, you can work out the damping and driving time scales by adding up all of the energy that's being taken out of the mode due to various viscous mechanisms, and comparing that to the energy that's being fed in by gravitational radiation, let them fight it out and see whose sign wins. And that tells you whether the overall time scale is positive or negative, and therefore whether the mode's really growing or not. Now, the important first test that this thing has to pass, that all of the other modes that people had looked at did not pass, is the very simplest semi-realistic model of a neutron star. This is something called an NPE fluid, which is just the idea is you just have this ordinary fluid composed of neutrons, protons, and electrons in chemical equilibrium between beta decay and its inverse, these reactions. As you get denser, you make more neutrons. Protons and electrons come together. That's how you get a neutron star in the first place. And you look at the viscosity mechanisms in this kind of matter, and there's basically two of them. There's a shear viscosity, which is, you know, from adjacent fluid elements having different velocities, and that can be worked out from neutron-neutron scattering cross-sections, for example. You go and you put that together and you get a macroscopic coefficient of viscosity, and it turns out that the damping rate due to that goes up as you go to lower temperatures, which is sort of typical, like, you know, motor oil. Well, you wouldn't know this in Santa Barbara, but motor oil in Milwaukee, for instance, gets really gloopy in the winter, and among other things. The second big viscosity mechanism, then, is this bulk viscosity. This is what's coming when you've got an oscillation going through a fluid element and compressing and rarefying it alternately. You're disturbing this chemical equilibrium between beta decay and the inverse. Every time you drive this reaction, you're making neutrinos or antineutrinos, and they basically leave. This is called the IRCA process, incidentally, for obscure reasons. And because the neutrinos are leaving, this is also responsible for the cooling. And so what's important here is that when you put in all the scalings, and this was the kind of stuff that Ray Sawyer was involved in, working out how to do this, take these microscopic reaction rates and make bulk viscosity coefficients and macroscopic coefficients out of it. You work out the damping rates for this, and it scales very strongly as the temperature. And there's a little frequency dependence too. Cooling rate's also strongly temperature dependent. Finally, you put in the gravitational radiation, and that, of course, is temperature independent, but it scales very strongly with the frequency. The driving rate, the inverse time scale, goes as frequency to the sixth power. And okay, so much for the scalings. You plug in some numbers, and yeah.
Oh, sorry to interrupt. Did you mention, or is there an easy way to understand why the bulk viscosity scales with omega?
Basically, because you're driving and damping this oscillator at a time scale off of what it wants to be. The reaction time scale is mismatched from the mode period. That comes into play even more towards the end of the talk, but for now, okay. So we've got these scalings worked out. Okay, so what about the numbers in front? That's where it really gets interesting. So you pick some sort of random typical value for a rapidly rotating neutron star. You see that the shear and the bulk viscosity are damping the mode on a time scale of, you know, decades or millennia even. And let me move this up so people can see it. The gravitational radiation is actually driving the mode on a time scale of something like 30 seconds. Wow, okay, this may be interesting after all. So you plot it up and get the canonical instability curve. All right, so this is the very first version, you know, very, very simple version for an NPE fluid. But people have been trying to redraw this graph correctly for several years now. First, I should explain the axes. We're looking at where neutron stars live in the frequency temperature plane. So omega is the rotational angular velocity of the star, and I've actually graphed it in these sort of funny obscure units, essentially to remove the equation of state dependence. We want to graph all the way up to the maximum rate a neutron star can spin before it flies off, stuff leaves at the equator. And while, because of the uncertainty in the equation of state, I can't tell you, no one can tell you whether this is a kilohertz or 2 kilohertz limit, I can tell you that in these funny units, it's always about 2/3. So we plot that out vertically and we plot the temperature. We're looking at a range starting around 10 to the 11 degrees, which is the more or less the temperature at which NPE matter becomes transparent to neutrinos. So, you know, a few seconds after the supernova, the matter becomes transparent to neutrinos, they leave, the star starts cooling by the Irca process pretty rapidly. It gets down to 10 to the 10 kelvins after about 30 seconds. And because the temperature dependence is very strong, then it creeps down to 10 to the 9 over the next year or so. And then it keeps getting cooler. Isolated neutron stars can actually get several orders of magnitude below this, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 kelvins, but there's a lot more viscosity and whatnot going on at low temperature. Already, even at 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10 kelvins, things are happening that we know are not accounted for in this instability. In the simple model of a neutron star, there's a crust forming, there's a superfluid transition in the stuff inside the crust. Various things get more complicated and they tend to raise the viscosity, which is a good thing. Okay, so I've plotted this temperature range because the low mass X-ray binaries, which are being kept hot by the accreting stuff burning, live, you know, more or less, you know, few hundred million degrees. So this blue curve then is actually the instability curve. This curve is defined by setting the gravitational radiation driving rate equal to the sum of the viscous damping rates. So the driving and the damping exactly cancel out. So above this curve, at least one R mode is unstable, and therefore the star should be spinning down until it hits the curve. And then below the curve, the modes are all stable. So the curve goes way up at high temperatures because the bulk viscosity, remember, has a high temperature dependence, and it's very effective at damping the star, damping the instability at high temperatures, and then shear viscosity takes over, although less effectively at low temperatures. Now, really, we know the shear viscosity portion of the graph right away, even from a theorist's point of view, has to be bogus because we know there ought to be a superfluid transition, a crust, various other things happening at lower temperatures, which is a good thing because observationally, we knew right away that this was bogus too because the low mass X-ray binaries are observed, you know, within these equation of state uncertainties to live either up in this box or maybe down in this box a bit. But anyway, they're far above this instability curve. So, you know, this predicts that they should be spinning down pretty rapidly, and you observe these things and they're not. Well, that's good. So we know that the other physics has to come in and raise the viscosity to say that these things aren't figments of the observer's imagination. But for young neutron stars, this looks really interesting because we can say, okay, maybe young neutron stars are formed up here right after a supernova, you've got something that's very hot, it's spinning as fast as it possibly can. Now, it starts cooling, so it's shooting out horizontally. Any bit of the boiling and bubbling after the supernova that looks like an R-mode is gonna get grabbed by a gravitational radiation and get amplified on a time scale of a few minutes until, well, we don't know what happens. That involves nonlinear hydro, which is hard to do. So here's one guess, which we had back in 98, which seems like ancient history now. This is sort of based on what happened with the F-modes, that you would say, okay, delta V, this, in some well-defined sense, the amplitude of this delta V grows to of order unity, compared to some typical fluid velocity in the star. So it basically takes over the star, and it just sits there constant, and the radiation from then on doesn't grow the mode, it spins the whole star down. And so after the mode's grown a bit, the neutron star follows this track and then tips over and starts spinning down and cooling, coincidentally on a time scale of about a year, to lose roughly an order of magnitude off of its angular momentum. And that's nice because that gets down roughly to where the crab is. Once again, theoretically, we know it gets dicey around here. It sort of peters out in this murky physics region. And observationally, it turns out as we were writing these papers, somebody discovered this funny looking number here is a roughly the frequency of this pulsar, young pulsar in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And for various reasons, the frequency is a bit uncertain, but it seems like it was going even faster than the crab and might have been around in here somewhere. So that's fine. It tells us that this instability at least is interesting to look further at, and that there's, because of these various inconsistencies, there's a lot more physics we can put in, and that's cool. So that's what people have been doing for the last 4 years. All right, beyond that simple neutron star model, there's a lot more that we can do, and that people have been doing. And boy, have they been doing it. Now, depending on how you count, there's been something like 80 to 100 papers dealing with some aspect of R modes, trying to predict whether they're real or whether they die, or what we can learn from them. And it's what I find really fascinating about it is that this topic winds up taking you on pretty much the entire tour of the Landau-Lifshitz volumes in theoretical physics. Of course, you're looking at the fluid dynamics volume right away and the mechanics, and you start looking, as I mentioned, at a crust, and you get the elasticity volume, and there's magnetohydrodynamics coming in at some point, and there's quantum field theory where you're calculating cross sections, and then there's the kinetic theory book where you're turning those microscopic cross sections into macroscopic coefficients of viscosity, and on and on and on. It touches on just about everything, usually taken to ridiculous extremes, so it's great. The downside of that, of course, is that in the 25 minutes remaining, there's no way I can do all this justice. So I'm going to be very picky here and just talk about basically five of the things that I think are physically most important for the very narrow-minded goal of deciding whether LIGO is actually going to see something. And I'll touch very briefly on a few of them and then talk in a little more detail about some that I know better and that people thought were real showstoppers at the end. So the first thing I mentioned around 10 to the 9 degrees or so, more or less, there is this phase transition. The ordinary fluid inside goes down into a superconducting superfluid state. That is, the neutrons pair up with other neutrons, the protons pair up with other protons, they make Cooper pairs, and ordinarily what happens is that means they're not free to scatter, and therefore the viscosity goes way, way down. People look at this in lab, superfluids have no viscosity. Fine, that's how it should be. But that's not how it is in neutron stars, it turns out. There's something very counterintuitive going on. Mainly, it was, we thought this was gonna be a showstopper, at least in the low temperature limit. Lee Limlim and Greg Mendel had been working on this and absolutely entirely killed the F modes, gravitational radiation instability, because it turns out, when you look at this carefully, there's this thing called mutual friction, which is, it's kind of a funny mechanism. It basically has to do with the fact that the star is rotating. Okay, a superfluid can't rotate, so it's got to have these little vortex cores of ordinary fluid where all the rotation is. And it turns out any magnetic field going through the star also has to go through these little vortex cores. Even if there is no external magnetic field, the fact that you've got protons circulating around in these things means that they'll make some magnetic field on their own. Now, the electrons are not going into superfluid state, so they're free to scatter, and they scatter off of these vortex cores, in such a way that the coefficient of viscosity turns out to be really tremendous, orders of magnitude greater than it was in the ordinary fluid case. And that completely killed all the other modes that people looked at. Lee and Greg went back and they looked at the R modes, and it turns out mutual friction does increase the damping a bit, but not as much as you might think. Probably only a very little bit, and so it doesn't actually move the lower portion of that instability curve up into the region where it agrees with observations of low mass X-ray binaries. So that was an interesting physical topic, but it turned out to be a bit of a red herring. Another thing that's pretty important, there are various people, mainly this bunch spearheaded by Luciano Rizzola, were very concerned about the effects of magnetic fields. So regardless of superfluid or not, even in the ordinary fluid state, this stuff is a good conductor, so the field lines are going to be frozen into the fluid. Now, they say, okay, if the gravitational radiation reaction on the R modes makes lots of differential rotation happen, this is going to have pretty dramatic consequences. The field lines are frozen into the fluid, so if the outer layers of the star are rotating slower and the inner layers are rotating fast, the fluid lines are frozen in, they'll get sort of wound up around the star, and they'll get very, very strong. You can get very arbitrarily strong fields almost, depending on how much energy the R mode is able to put in. That's bad for the R mode instability spinning down the star because it's taking a lot of energy out, but that's really interesting on an astrophysics level because that might explain, if you can amplify a small seed magnetic field into a large one, where the magnetic fields in neutron stars come from, young ones. Now, that's kind of a puzzle too. Of course, this is all begging the question of, is there any differential rotation? And I just found out yesterday that apparently there, or the day before yesterday, that apparently there actually is. John Friedman and some people associated with him had been working on it, and they had just come to a conclusion that there is a bit. It's a very, very tricky question to answer because fundamentally it's related to nonlinear hydrodynamics, which is the next big thing. And there's been another recent development there, which I'll get to at the end, but basically people, once again, have been trying to solve the nonlinear Euler equation since Euler, and basically haven't been able to do it. But even in the age of modern computers, it's a nightmare. There are all sorts of numerical and mathematical instabilities, headaches to deal with it. But in the last year or so, there was a group at the AEI and a Caltech LSU group who had been working on nonlinear hydro from various angles, various numerical codes, and they found that having a large mode amplitude in the sense of delta V over background V of the star being comparable to unity is apparently okay. In their simulations, they did things like they put an R mode on a star and they watched it evolve to see if it got damped out on a rotation period of the star sort of time scale, and it didn't. And what the Caltech LSU group did is actually really nice because they made some nice pictures about it, and they came up with a result where they after they put on a small R mode and let it grow due to radiation reaction, they found that essentially what happens is the mode, as the other guys found, can grow to pretty high amplitude, and then something very remarkably like surf happens in their simulation. This is basically a couple of snapshots of a cross-section of a neutron star. So here we're looking at the rotation axis. There's the North Pole and the South. And these lines here are density contours. They're logarithmic in units of the square root of 10. So this is, here's central density. This contour is down by a factor of 3. This is down by a factor of 10. That's down by 30 and so on. And what you see is that most of the interior of the star is unperturbed. The vast majority of the mass in the star is unperturbed and incidentally doesn't suffer from any differential rotation. But what they get is that this stuff on the surface is doing wild things, forming surface waves, which break and crash over, just like surf. And what you get is these shocks forming, which are incredibly dissipative and damp out the mode very quickly on a time scale of, say, a rotational period, a millisecond or a couple milliseconds. And so basically, instead of this picture before, where we had the time evolution of delta B being, okay, it grows exponentially and then hits a large value and stays flat, these guys are getting the result that it grows exponentially, hits a large value, and then crashes down, and presumably starts up again and then crashes again several times. So there's not a smooth spin down, there's a series of things happening. There are some there are some problems. In order to do this, they actually had to multiply the strength of gravitational radiation by a factor of something like 5,000. Basically, things happen slowly in real life, and you run out of computing budget long before you can model this. And that gets that leaves some room for error, as I'll talk about later on. But at the moment, I would like to talk about something that certainly got some play over here. The fourth thing on my list of the complicated things is the effect of a solid crust. So this is something actually that Lars worked on, and Greg Ushimirsky. They scared us all a couple years ago with this prediction that the R modes would be pretty much damped out. So first, a bit of background on the structure of neutron stars as they get a little more complicated. Roughly speaking, you go below a temperature of something like 10 to the 10 kelvins, and for the outer layers, densities below about half nuclear density, or 1.5 times 10 to the 14 in CGS units, what happens is basically as you get into the star at higher densities, the neutron fraction goes up. And while you're in this outer layer, you have more than about 3% protons. You're able to maintain a more or less solid crystalline lattice. That is, you know, remember, in order to make a lattice, you need the positively charged nuclei holding things in place. And as the fraction of protons goes down and down as you get to higher temperatures, eventually there's too much inertia per unit of charge on the nuclei, and they can't hold things in place anymore, and the whole thing falls apart into sludge. And so the inner layers never solidify, but the outer layers, you know, within seconds after the supernova, apparently do. And you get maybe out of, say, 10 or 12 kilometer radius of a typical neutron star, if you look at this wedge taken out of it, you get maybe the outer kilometer or 2 kilometers being this sort of solid crust, which is made out of these incredibly neutron-rich nuclei, and actually, generally, there's some free neutrons floating around in between them, too. I should mention, I will talk about more later on, down in the inner kilometer or two, there's some funny particles living, hyperions, maybe other things. And actually, you get a cross-section that looks remarkably like the Earth. There's this fluid, or maybe superfluid, mantle. There's an inner core of funny stuff. There's a solid crust. There's actually ocean of order 10 meters or so deep. And then there's this, you know, magnetosphere and all sorts of very low-density stuff happening as you go outside. The really remarkable thing here is that out of this whole 10 kilometers or so, what really matters, as far as the R-modes are concerned, when you start forming a crust, is this little boundary layer, which is less than a millimeter or so in thickness at the temperatures we're looking at. That controls the whole thing, it turns out. That may look a little strange, but that's actually very typical in fluid mechanics. You get this all the time where, you know, whirlpools and vortices in the air and all that are coming from a very tiny layer next to a solid surface that they're flowing past. See, what usually happens is you get what's called a no-slip boundary condition. If you've got a fluid flowing past a solid, the relative velocity of the fluid has to go to zero as you move to the boundary with the solid, and it has to do that very rapidly on a length scale that's controlled by the microscopic coefficient of viscosity. So this looks a little weird, but it's actually pretty typical, even when you're talking about water flowing in pipes. And the really scary thing is, when you work out roughly what's going on, the shear, remember, is part of the gradient of the velocity. And therefore, even though you've got this very tiny layer that's, you know, down in size by a factor of 10 to the 7 from the 10 kilometer radius of the star, which is what the R modes are typically operating on, since the length scale goes down by 10 to the 7, your gradients go up by 10 to the 7. When you put in all the scalings, which Lars and Greg did, you know, that means that the damping rate due to shear viscosity in this boundary layer is going to go up by a factor of 10 to the 7 or so. That really scared us for a while, but there's a couple things going on that this sort of simple picture leaves out. The first thing is, calling this crust solid is really a bad idea. It's really not. Remember, sort of the bottom boundary of the crust is defined by 3% proton fraction, and most of the mass is actually in the bottom layers of the crust, where you're pretty close to that, you know, say 5 or 10% proton fraction. And so you do have some sort of a crystal lattice. You do have enough charge for that, but since the mass to charge ratio is so high, the nuclei are not very effective at holding the lattice together. And if you reduce all of condensed matter physics down to one number, basically the ratio of the pressure to the shear modulus, this stuff turns out to be essentially identical to Jell-O. Very dense, very hot Jell-O, but Jell-O nonetheless. So what happens is as you might imagine with Jell-O, if it's sitting on top of this fluid that's moving along pretty fast, for the most part, it's going to tend to flow or get dragged along with the fluid. And so actually, the relative slip velocity between the fluid and the, quote, solid crust is going to be substantially reduced. Another thing is, where is all that energy going? So remember, when we talk about gravitational radiation driving the R modes, we're talking about something that was going to take out 10 to the 49 ergs worth of kinetic energy from the star. And now we're saying that it gets killed by this sheer viscosity in this millimeter thick boundary layer. Well, what happens when you're putting that amount of energy into a layer a millimeter thick is it gets very, very hot, or it tries to. It turns out, there's a long story here, which I don't have time to go into, but there's a sort of chicken and egg thing going, and the upshot of it is that if the R mode is running as it seems to be in a young neutron star, before the crust tries to form, it isn't that the crust prevents the R modes, it's the R modes prevent the crust. So you see something like this, for instance, when you're looking at pack ice forming in the Arctic. The ocean in some places never freezes over, really, even up to very high latitudes. You look at the boundary in winter, it's not a simple straight line at a constant latitude. It's very jagged, depending on the ocean currents. What's going on is that as the fluid cools, you're trying to get this solid form on top, but the relative velocity means that there's a significant amount of heating in this boundary layer, which heats the fluid back up to melting temperature, or heats the solid back up to melting temperature. Well, you can't go above melting temperature, because if you get too hot, then the dissipation's gone, and you're back down to melting temperature, so you stay right at melting temperature in this intermediate state. And in the Arctic, what happens is you've got this pack ice phenomenon where you've got chunks of ice floating around, and the viscosity is actually not coming from the molecules hitting each other and transporting momentum that way, it's coming from the chunks of ice banging off each other. And you work out how that works, and it turns out that if the R mode has reached a relative velocity of 10 to the minus 3 compared to the background of the star, when the crust is trying to form, then it'll prevent the crust from forming. You'll get this sort of slushy pack ice scenario, and a young neutron star will continue evolving down almost to the frequency it would have before. But in a young neutron star, or in an older neutron star, low mass X-ray binary, where you've got the crust in place and before the R modes happen, things are different. This actually has a very nice effect on the instability curve. No one's really put all the pieces together quite properly, so I've tried to cobble together a couple of results on these two complications, and what you get is roughly an instability curve that looks like this. With a moving crust, you get this line that has gone up from the perfect fluid case, or sorry, the simple fluid case, purely fluid case, by a factor of several. And the nice thing is, in the temperature regime where low mass X-ray binaries are expected to live, well, guess what? They're either below this line or sitting right on the line. And that's good, because that tells us that we're not actually completely conflicting with observations anymore. The theory may actually be right down there. For a young neutron star, actually, this portion of the curve doesn't even exist. What happens with a young neutron star, it comes down the same way it did before, with this slushy pack ice forming, and it punches right through this barrier and keeps on going down a bit. That jag is an attempt at dealing with a superfluid transition. Different scatterers, basically little electrons at this point.
What's spinning down the young neutron star?
The emission of gravitational radiation. It's carrying off.
Why doesn't it stop the moving crust line? I guess you said it drops below the line.
So it drops below the line because as I was saying, there's this moving fluid that the pack ice or slush is trying to stay on top of, and if you formed a neutron star here and the R mode didn't have time to grow before the crust formed, the crust would solidify. But since the R mode is there, presumably a neutron star is starting off up here. A crust doesn't even form without an R mode until 10 to the 10. So the R mode's going, the crust tries to form on top of it, but it can't. And the instability proceeds almost as far as it would have without the crust. There is an effect, basically, that at some point the rotational energy is no longer enough to keep this crust heated, or wannabe crust heated up, and the whole thing locks together and solidifies. But that actually happens somewhere around here, rather than somewhere up here. Okay, so that was one showstopper, one bullet that we dodged. But then another thing came up. So as I said before, in my little graph of a neutron star wedge, there are some funny particles probably living in the core. There are various possibilities for funny particles that people like to talk about, but as far as I can tell, the least far out one are these things called hyperons. This is another pretty obscure thing. Hyperons are not exactly a household name any more than R-modes are, or were. But basically what they are, if you're mathematically minded, they're the bottom octet of SU3 cross SU3 cross SU3. If you're more seat of the pants physical, these are neutrons and protons with a strange quark stuck in them. So the main ones we're interested in for neutron stars are a thing called a lambda, which is an up-down strange state, and a sigma minus, which is down-down strange. These weigh in at 11 or 1200 MeV, and you can start forming them once the neutrons are getting densely packed enough that the Fermi energy the kinetic part of the Fermi energy is a couple hundred MeV, so you have extra energy to compensate for the extra rest mass of these things. Now, of course, anything dealing with equation of state of very dense matter is going to be kind of uncertain. There are some error bars involved, but broadly speaking, it seems to be a pretty robust result that these things, or things very like them, live in the inner kilometer or so of reasonable typical neutron stars. Some of the reasons this conclusion is pretty robust are pressure and isospin. So on the pressure front, if you imagine you've got 1200 MeV to spend on either a neutron that's moving around really fast, 300 MeV kinetic energy, or a hyperon that's just sitting there, well, the star wants to make a hyperon because the neutron's gonna be banging around really fast. That makes pressure. The hyperon's sitting there, that doesn't make much pressure, and so the star can crunch down a little bit more and save on gravitational potential energy. There's also a very strong incentive in terms of the isospin symmetry. You might remember neutrons and protons sort of act like they're states of the same particle before people knew about SU3, and that nuclei are happiest, they have their lowest energy when there are equal numbers of neutrons and protons. And obviously, when you're talking about 97% neutrons, 3% protons, the system is way out of whack. It really badly wants to make any other particles out of neutrons that it can, to the tune of several hundred MeV per baryon. Now, there's a whole zoo of reactions that can go on here. There are things like the IRCA process involving leptons and neutrinos and all that, which I won't go into, because it turns out the main ones of interest to us are these non-leptonic ones. Here's a couple of pretty typical examples. You're talking about basically scattering processes where the scatterers change identities. And this is something that actually occurred when I was visiting here about a year and a half ago. This guy, Peter Jones at Oxford, dug out this 30-year-old paper that he had written on damping out turbulence and supernova core collapse, and these really obscure reactions that he had treated in connection with that. So he went and updated a bit. We went and looked at it some more. He was claiming that the bulk viscosity would be very large and would kill the instability entirely. And the reason this works, or actually I should say the reason bulk viscosity in general works, is you're talking about matching, roughly speaking, a reaction time scale to a mode oscillation period. So if the reactions are proceeding infinitely fast, you're always in equilibrium, there's no effect. If your reactions are infinitely slow, the reactions never happen and generate entropy, so there's no effect. But in the intermediate regime, what happens is if you take some fluid element and you look at the pressure of that fluid element versus the volume, the equation of state, that is when the system is in equilibrium and you very, very slowly compress it or rarefy it, it wants to sit along some line. That's usually plotted as pressure versus density, if you like. It's the same thing, just going the other way. But anyway, there's this equilibrium line where it wants to sit. And if you start jiggling this thing at some frequency more or less comparable to the reaction timescales, what happens is you start compressing this fluid a bit. Now, you're trying to make hyperons, but not fast enough, so there are too many neutrons. They're banging around fast. They're making too much pressure, so you go out above this equilibrium curve. And then when the reverse happens, you're trying to make hyperons back into neutrons, but you're not doing it fast enough, the pressure's too low, and you scoot below. And obviously, you're integrating around the cycle PdV, you're having to turn mechanical energy into heat, essentially, by this kind of a process. Now, it turns out, when you look at these non-leptonic reactions, the reaction time scales are pretty fast. They're of order, say, a microsecond in dense matter. That's a factor of 10 to the 3 faster than the millisecond mode time scale, mode period. But that's not infinitely fast. It's fast enough, it's comparable enough that the viscosity coefficient is very large. And in addition, here's another weird thing about neutron stars and the instability, that superfluidity, turns out there's this phase transition around 10 to the 10 kelvins for the hyperons, so these things are almost always superfluid when you're interested in them. Again, you might think that would help you out and reduce the viscosity. It turns out to slow the reactions down, of course, and guess what? Now you've gone from microseconds to milliseconds, same as the mode period, and the bulk viscosity coefficient goes up by orders of magnitude. The net result of that is very different from the original instability curve. At first glance, it doesn't look so bad. If you go and you update all the numbers and try and put in the best of the present day knowledge of the microphysics, you get something that looks like this. And you see this curve going down. Okay, now we're only going 10 to the 11, 10 to the 9 kelvins. It goes down, okay, still by more than a factor of 2 from the maximum spin frequency. So, okay, that looks all right. But the time scale here has changed. One other thing that the hyperons do is they vastly increase the cooling rate of the neutron star. The neutrino reactions, the IRCA process gets dramatically speeded up. One of the bottlenecks gets removed, and now instead of talking about going to 10 to the 10 kelvins on a time scale of 30 seconds, which remember is one growth time scale for the R mode, takes you down to, well, okay, it's dense matter, there are uncertainties, but it's around in here somewhere, which is right where this steep wall is coming up and cutting off the instability. So that's pretty bad. Instead of the core is cooling so fast that a neutron star is essentially going to shoot straight across, and maybe only go down a little bit before it gets before the colder temperatures stabilize the R modes. This result unfortunately seems to be pretty robust. You can play around with a lot of the uncertainties in the microphysics, and essentially the scalings kill you. You'll note that this wall is pretty steep. There's a strong temperature dependence of the microphysics, and gravitational radiation has a very strong frequency dependence. So when you know, with these high power scalings, when you get the factors out in front wrong by, you know, a factor of 2 or 3, which is fairly easy, you're not talking about a factor of 2 or 3 error in this graph, you're talking about the 8th root of 2 or something like that. It is possible, given the uncertainties in nuclear physics, that hyperons might not exist or might just barely exist on the cores of neutron stars, but you really have to push several parameters to the extremes of what's consistent with experimental data. So,
are you talking about a generic neutron star? What about ones that are very low mass?
Ones that are very low mass, like, say, you know, 1.2 solar masses or something like that, might not have hyperons. But nobody's ever seen one of these. And so I think, unfortunately, I think pretty much this means that the game is over. It was fun while it lasted, but it's pretty robustly dead now. We've learned some interesting physics along the way, but this is about where it stands. So that was the rise and fall of the R modes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Did somebody get the light? So we've only learned something if all neutron stars have 1.4 solar masses.
Right. Well, all the ones we have observed have those masses, but of course, you know, there could be a selection effect. Maybe only the 1.4s like to emit radio waves. I don't know.
You got rid of the external crust problem by making sludge and gel. That's all taken care of. But you take that picture where you had your hyperion core, and don't ask me why, because then I'd be talking for an hour. But you replace it with a crystallized, very, very solid, non-slushy, non-jello core, the entire hyperion core region. Now, can the R mode solve the problem of just going to zero amplitude at a finite radius, or does that disqualify?
Okay, so in that case, yeah, you're going to have a different boundary condition. If yeah, so if you just clamped down the center of the star, which is actually one thing that people sometimes object to about this hyperon business, you've got this huge viscosity, whether it's due to solid core or hyperons or anything, huge viscosity in one place. Well, the mode extends through the whole star, so you know, wouldn't it just not exist down there? And you wouldn't get any damping. Well, yeah, the mode would change shape. The eigenfunction would go to zero at the boundary instead of at the center, and it would be a different mode. But of course, if you do have a very solid core, what happens is that you would get another boundary layer happening between the fluid and the core. I don't know how the eigenfunction would grow away from that layer. But my guess is you would still get some pretty significant damping. And I should say, so you didn't ask this, but other people have, you know, is the hyperon viscosity just going to clamp the mode like that and reduce it to zero in the core so there's no dissipation? And the answer is no. Turns out the condition to clamp like that is that you have to take the mode energy out on a time scale comparable to a mode period. Now, the hyperon bulk viscosity is strong in the sense that it's stronger than the gravitational radiation pretty quickly, but the gravitational radiation is operating on a time scale of, you know, 10,000 or 100,000 mode periods. And the hyperon bulk viscosity is still operating nowhere nearly as quickly as one mode period. So the mode does keep its shape unless you have very, very strong viscosity.
Now, we heard talks by Will Deck and his collaborators who would replace that entire hyperon region with quark matter.
Quark soup, yeah.
Quark soup.
Right. Yeah, and that's pretty reasonable at some point because, you know, the baryons are going to be touching, and then what do you do? Well, it turns out basically there's the same kind of reaction that happens, except now instead of, if you draw the Feynman diagrams for these things, you're basically talking about a strange quark going to an up quark and popping off a W boson and interacting, changing an up to a down on the other particle. And, you know, in these reactions that we actually considered, it's exactly the same thing as that quark interaction, except each quark has two other quarks along for the ride, because it's sitting in a baryon.
Yeah.
But you get a very similar effect.
Yeah, high temperatures, but I was going to ask you another question. The baryons of these models have no electrons in them at all. You just neutralize with your quark. I don't know what those other ones we've got to use.
Oh, no, you don't need electrons for this.
Question about COVID. Now you explained the high viscosity in the superfluid thing by scattering of electrons on the vortices. If there are no electrons and everything is super, is it the same dissipation?
No, that was the case for the neutron and proton fluid that you got scattering off of the vortices. In the case of the hyperons, superfluidity makes the viscosity go up. Even without vortices, superfluidity makes the viscosity go up simply because the reaction time scale gets matched. At low temperatures, you have to get pretty low. So the core has to cool to something like 10 to the 8 or 10 to the 9 degrees, by which time the crust has definitely formed in the absence of the R mode. And then it's very hard to start the thing up with the crust there.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask. So what about the accreting systems if you kept going on this plot down to 10 to the 8 or below 10 to the 8?
If you keep going on this plot, eventually it comes back down again. But it's a pretty long way. So we haven't actually looked at the accreting systems pretty much because Lee and I are both kind of set against them because of the crust, and also because of the existence of the 600 hertz pulsar. But yeah, it does eventually go down, but I don't know exactly where. I don't know if it's possible in some accreting systems that you can still get a mode.
Are there any other potential gravitational wave sources from which physics above nuclear densities is important?
Okay, so where do you get physics above nuclear densities? Okay, the neutron stars or the supernova core collapse? Well, sorry, either supernova core collapse or getting a couple of neutron stars to come together. Now, there is going to be some period, you know, they have far too much angular momentum to make a Kerr black hole, so there is going to be some relatively long period, you know, maybe like a few seconds or so, when you've got this something made out of nuclear matter with bits of super dense, more than nuclear matter, rotating around very fast. And that might, you know, that might be subject to various other kinds of instabilities. You know, that's the kind of thing Jones-Centrella works on. And there are things, you know, there are bar mode instabilities that happen. And I think there's something similar that happens when you've got a torus. So my guess is, you know, people have been looking at these other, you know, supernova and, you know, and spiraling neutron star sources for a while. And those may actually be helped out a bit by some of this matter at supernuclear densities. But I don't know. This is still pretty brand new. People haven't really thought out the consequences very well yet.
Here's like one more question. So I'm trying to understand the pessimism. So I understand the pessimism from this temperature range, but explain to me, I mean, if you believe you're pessimistic for this, then why aren't you optimistic about the case where it turns back down and it's still observable? I mean, you either believe the calculation or you don't. So if you believe it here and you're pessimistic, then why aren't you optimistic in the other case? That's what I don't understand. In the lower.
I'm not optimistic in the other case, in the lower temperature case. I think it's bad there. I should mention.
But I mean, if it's in a realm where, you know, it's 500 or 600 hertz, isn't that relevant? Or are you saying it's not relevant?
If it's 500 or 600 hertz, that could be pretty interesting. Except there's more trouble on the horizon, which I didn't have time to include in this talk because the paper just came out a couple days ago. There is some new work, sort of semi-analytical work, on the nonlinear hydro mode-mode coupling by Anna Flanagan, Saltykolsky, the Cornell group, and, you know, and some people associated with them, like Sharon Morsink, where they say that nonlinear fluid effects cut off the growth of the R mode at an amplitude of 10 to the minus a few,
sure,
two or three.
It doesn't limit the spin, it just means you can't detect it with LIGO.
Yeah, it means you can't detect it with LIGO, but as far as limiting the spin on the old neutron stars, okay, so there's, if the boundary layer actually goes turbulent, which I think it does once you're above 10 to the minus 3 or so, then that forces things onto this attractor, which is not as observed apparently. It forces things to track through this line in the instability diagram. And in general, I'm a little iffy because it seems like, you know, for the low temperature stuff, the R modes are a little too good. If they exist in one neutron star holding it down at 300 hertz, then they should exist in all neutron stars. So how come we see things at 600? I mean, it looks like you would have to cool very, very far to get to the point where the viscosity would go up high enough again to allow you 600, if it's really at 300 in the LMXB temperature range. And of course, you can say, okay, we're accreting a few atoms per year over 1,800 Hubble times, but, you know, that you get into practical difficulties at some point. I don't know where that point is. This isn't based on any careful calculation. This is at least as much prejudice as anything else. But I just think the R modes are too generic to be the solution at low temperatures.
Okay, well, thank you.